Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Casino City Gang, your podcast for all things gambling. Today is February 23rd, 2012, and we've got a great show for you here today. I'm your host, Aaron Todd, broadcasting from Casino City's worldwide headquarters just outside of Boston. And joining me from here in our studios is Vin Narayanan. Vin, how are you feeling this morning? Oh, Vin, you are not in. I keep trying to add Vin into the show, but for some reason the studio won't let him come in. Also joining us, and hopefully I can stop this music because my browser is not really cooperating right now, so we're having lots of issues with the show. But also joining us, and I'm sure he is in, is Dan Igo. Dan, I know you're not feeling well this morning. He's at home. I hope things are going well, and if you have to leave us during the broadcast, we understand. How you feeling?
I'll give you guys a heads up. I think I'll be good for the next hour or so, though.
Okay, that's good. There we go. We finally got the music to stop, and hopefully I can get Vin on the line here in a minute. But I know Dan's not feeling the greatest right now, but I've got a feeling when looking at our brackets for the Accenture Match Play Championship, he is feeling much better than I am. Dan is currently leading in a pool that we are all participating in, while I am not leading. I think I'm in 42nd out of 48 people, and I've lost both of my finalists, so I've already given up hope, and I am definitely rooting for Dan the rest of the way. Vin, you were on for a second, and then it went away. Gotta love browsers. Anyway, we're going to start the show out by talking about Dan's recent trip over the weekend. He went to Atlantic City. Dan, can you tell us about the trip? And I believe it was your first successful trip to Atlantic City in terms of the bottom line. Why were you there, and how did it go, and what was the big winner for you?
Well, it was a fraternity reunion. It's the second year we've done it. We had about 60 guys go. So we had an open. Most of us stay at the Hilton. I don't think it's called the Hilton anymore. It's bankrupt, and the Hilton name has been removed from the hotel. You can see the outline of the word Hilton, but the actual name is removed. But we had an open bar at Tropicana, which was nice. It was a good trip. I won a couple $100 the first time since I've been going to Atlantic City the last 4 years or so. First time I've come out ahead. I got lucky I was on a few hot craps tables that bumped my bankroll up without really having to do much of anything besides making, pass line bets and taking odds and those types of things. I got lucky on a couple of big roulette, red or black bets. And then I won a little bit playing blackjack, a little bit better than even, which is usually not the case. But, it was a good trip. The Hilton was the first time I'd stayed at the Hilton, or the Artist formerly known as the Hilton. And, it was a decent enough casino. The table limits were low the entire night, which was huge for a lot of us. After the open bar ended at 12, a few of the older heads, a few of the older higher rollers, stayed at the Tropicana to gamble because they wanted to play the $25 limit games, and the rest of us poor kids, shuffled back over to Hilton right next door so we could play the $5 and $10 games.
ACH is the smallest of the casinos there, Dan. Did you feel like you were missing out gambling at the smallest of the casinos, or do you feel like that really worked out to your advantage?
I think it works for my advantage. There were always rooms at the tables. There were enough table games to go around, too. It wasn't hard to find a spot at a craps table. It wasn't hard to find a $10 or $15 blackjack game. I enjoyed it. It was, like I said before, it was my first time at the Hilton. Before I'd only, I'd gamble at the Trop, I'd gambled at the Borgata, and I'd gambled at Harris. And, once, it's prime time over at those places, those limits start going up, and then you're less likely to play some blackjack, or play roulette or play craps.
Yeah.
So,
that's one of the interesting things about Atlantic City in general is when the people start showing up, those table limits, jack up in a hurry. And it happens in Vegas, too, so I'm not trying to say it doesn't happen in Vegas. But it is a lot harder to find, say, a $15 blackjack table in Atlantic City at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night than it is to find a $15 blackjack table at Vegas at 10 o'clock at night, because the clock strikes 10 and everything's up to $25.
Oh, and it was President's Day weekend too, which is definitely one of the busier weekends of the winter season. The weather was pretty nice. There was no one had to really worry about snow or anything like that. So, Atlantic City was pretty crowded last weekend. The hotel rates, we stayed at the Hilton, which is one of the lower end hotels, and it was still I think $250 for a room for a Saturday night. So, it wasn't the when you're splitting it four or five ways, it's not bad. But it was a good trip. It was I got to see a casino that I've never seen before, and I'd recommend for those who want a cheaper throw at Atlantic City to definitely consider the Hilton when you're making your AC plans.
Now, I actually stayed at the Hilton for a bachelor party last summer, or two summers ago, I guess it was.
It is the boardwalk budget spot.
And, we stayed there, and I'd had a really bad run at the poker tables the whole trip, and woke up the morning that we were set to leave and went down and found the one-to-two-table poker room they have at the Hilton, or what was formerly known as the Hilton, and managed to book a small win there, which had me feeling a little bit better about the trip overall. But I find it interesting that a place would even have a 1-to-2-table poker room. Dan, did you see a poker area? Do they still have that there? And if so, was there any action going on there?
I believe there was an area. I know one of my poker degenerate friends was able to hop on a table. It was after I went to bed. I think it was like 4:35 in the morning, he told me. But I think it's the people in my group who really wanted to play poker, they walked over to the Trop and played. It's a much bigger room over there. There's more action over at the Trop, definitely, especially with poker, than at the Hilton.
Oh, yeah, well, the two best poker rooms, at least for my money in Atlantic City, the two best poker rooms there are at the Borgata and then at the Trump Todge. I mean, those are the two places where most of the AC regulars go to play poker. A poker room that's nice that a lot of regulars don't go to play at, but I think as nice as over at Caesars. I think they've got a decent poker room there, too. But most of the poker traffic in Atlantic City goes to either the Trump Todge or the Borgata. So it doesn't surprise me that the ACH has a one- or two-table setup. And they probably do the setup. I mean, I'm sure they have cash games in there, but they probably do the setup just so they can hold single-table tournaments for daily tournaments, so they can, tell some of their younger customers that they've got a poker room and you can come play in a tournament there. I mean, the ACH is interesting. I mean, I stayed in its Hilton incarnation. I've stayed there a few times, and the clientele there is really odd. You've got a combination of people who are there because the rooms there were cheaper than everywhere else, and you've got them, but they never seem to stay at the ACH to do stuff. And then you've got others who are perfectly content to stay in the ACH and then do everything there, but it's a much smaller minority. Dan, just in terms of time spent in Atlantic City, were you spending, I mean, you mentioned how some of your friends went to the Trop. Was most of the time at the Trop in the ACH, or did you guys hit any other properties while you were there?
Those were the two. It took me 6 hours to drive down there on Saturday. I left Sunday morning, so it was a quick shot for me. I was probably only in Atlantic City for 18 hours or so. So it was just the ACH and the Trop. That was it. Some people tried to get a movement to go to the Borgata late at night, but that didn't really didn't gain much traction, and the idea was it was quickly fizzled. But we stayed mostly in those two areas.
Now, how would you say? I mean, we've talked a lot about Atlantic City and how they've needed to find ways to get more people visiting and more people there. You know, on a big holiday weekend, you know, what was the traffic like? Did you, was it, you know, was every, were the places you were at packed? You know, what was it? Or, you know, you sounded like it wasn't too difficult to find a table at the Hilton, so.
No, but I would think that would normally be the case because it's more the one of the more run-down AC spots. The Tropicana was very, very busy. The restaurants were all packed. You know, our open bar was in a, it was in a bar. It was in a secluded area of, I forget what bar it is now at the Trop, but we were in, you know, in the back. And the actual bar restaurant of this establishment was completely full. The tables were all full when we walked through it to get outside to walk back to the Hilton. It looked like it was a pretty good weekend for Atlantic City. I left early enough the next morning where, you know, I didn't hit much traffic. And I think, you know, a lot of people didn't have to work on Mondays either. So they probably, you know, were able to stay two nights instead of just one night for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, ever since there's been a casino in the ACH property, it's struggled. I mean, it's the smallest of the casinos there, and they've struggled to attract revenue. And there was some thinking that by, you know, Hilton disassociated itself from the property. It didn't find it profitable, just the way it disassociated itself from the Las Vegas Hilton, which is now the LVH. Aren't these properties just creative? There was some thought that, you know, perhaps losing the Hilton name would improve the chances of the property as a casino because people would stop thinking of it. You think Hilton, you think business hotel. I mean, I think that's the general. You think business hotel, cookie cutter, the same, and, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Hilton's are perfectly nice places to stay, but you don't think vacation destination, except for the Hilton in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is just vacation destination. So there's some thought of that, and yeah, it's. Hopefully the ACH survives in its current incarnation. I mean, Revel's coming in now. Did you drive past any of the Revel construction, Dan?
I didn't. I actually, I asked around with the group I was in. No one seemed to know where it was, but I didn't see any of it. But you know, from what I've read, you know, it looks like it's actually going to happen. It's been in the cards now for years and years and years. But it sounds like it's getting moving, and you know, once it's completed. You know, it could be the Atlantic City's version of the city center.
Yeah, no, it's opening this year, that's for sure. So, okay, it's good. I'm glad ACH is still around. I've got fond memories of that place. I mean, the other thing I do, Dan, I don't know whether you and your group tried this, but there have been times like Michigan State played in a basketball tournament last year, I think it was, in Atlantic City. So went down for the game, and I ran into the same thing you did, which was $250 room rates across the city. And I was like, forget this. And I ended up staying like in a Motel 6, which was right across the street from all the big casinos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we saw. I don't know if we saw the Motel 6. It was like a Quality Inn. You know, I think there's a few of them.
Yeah, it could have been the Quality Inn or Super 8 or something like that.
None of my friends did that, but we did have about 8 to 10 kids stay at someone's beach house, which was, I think, in Ventnor, which is right down, you know, that's town over. So that was
it. If you're familiar with the Monopoly board, you know Ventnor.
Yeah. So it was spread out a little bit. There's some of the more economically smart people, I guess, stayed at a beach house, but. You know, then you have to worry about cabs at the end of the night and all that stuff. I thought it was just easier to, you know, pay my fee at the Hilton and know that I have a bed and I have, you know, an easy in, easy out when I want to leave the following morning.
Now, did you guys go out to eat at a nice place?
We went to there was a little bit of an upscale burger bar at the Hilton. I don't remember what it's called now. Nick's Burger Bar, maybe. There was about 10 of us who went there right when we got in. And it was good. You know, they had, it was a little more expensive than your normal burger fare. I think mine cost, you know, $16 or $17. But I got, you know, Kobe beef burger with, some chipotle mayo and cheese, and it was very good. It was very good. It was worth the
man rolling high with Kobe beef burger.
It was right after. Well, it was right after I had won the over $150 doing nothing at playing craps. Which was right out of that pot roll, so I was free rolling.
You mentioned the cabs in Atlantic City. That if you're staying outside the city, that you got to get a cab. One of the most interesting things I found about Atlantic City is that you don't. There's not a meter. You go up and you negotiate your rate with a cab driver. Like, you tell them where you're going. If you're going outside the city, I stayed at a beach house with some friends for this bachelor party a couple of years ago. And we go up to this cab driver and we're like, will you take us here? And he's like, well, how much do you want to pay? I said, how much do I want to pay? I want to pay you a dollar. Like, how much is it going to cost? And he just drove away because he was really angry. I didn't know that there was this whole bartering process. So that's one of the very interesting things for those of you who are thinking about a trip to Atlantic City and, have yet to go.
Just be prepared to haggle.
Absolutely, and definitely, drive a hard bargain, because if they know you're from out of town and you don't know how to bargain, they're going to charge you $10 to $15 more than you should be paying. So make sure you start low, and apparently you can't start at a dollar, though, because they'll just get angry and drive away. But anyway, speaking of, business arrangements that haven't worked out the best in terms of, from a cab driver to...
I thought you were going to say, speaking of angry.
No. Well, that works, too. We're going to switch from one angry customer to another. There's a recent, as Vin termed it this morning when we were discussing topics for the show today, a recent soap opera in the gambling world. For those of you who haven't been following it closely, Steve Wynn and a former business associate, Kazuo Okada, aren't so friendly anymore. So, Vin, you've been following this story closely. What can you tell us about how this whole thing started and how it has so quickly devolved?
This is perhaps the biggest soap opera going on, not just in the gambling industry, but globally, just in terms of business in general. And believe me, this is big business. So Kazuo Okada is a Japanese gazillionaire, and he made his money selling pachinko machines. And for those of you that don't know what a pachinko machine is, pachinko machines are, Japanese gambling devices. Many of them that look like video games, actually, now. I mean, they really do, but they're Japanese gambling devices. And he somehow managed, and we won't get into how he did this, although you can draw your own conclusions, to not only sell the machines, but keep 95% of the revenue generated by those machines. And so he made a lot of money. And so he bankrolled Steve Wynn's building of the casinos, and he bankrolled Wynn Enterprises, and then he helped bankroll Wynn Macau. So he had a 20% share stake in Wynn's company, and he's also on the board at Wynn Macau. And he helped Steve Wynn break into the Macau market as well. So helped in Vegas, helped in Macau. And the two were good friends. In fact, Wynn had enough respect for him and friendship for him, and in his way, sort of a minor way, thank you. There was a Japanese restaurant in either Wynn or Encore, I forget which, named Okada. So these were good friends. And then all of a sudden, Okada's pachinko revenue started to drop. He said, I need to make up for this revenue, this drop in revenue. Let me see if I should get into gambling myself. And so he decided, I'm going to build some casinos in the Philippines. Steve Wynn was not happy about that. In a combination of factors, the casinos might compete with his Macau interests, combined with, he might want to expand to the Philippines himself at some point. And he went nuts, and he's like, no, you can't do this. So that's where the rift began, and it began to grow, and it's turned into a messy soap opera. So Okada, sort of unhappy with Wynn, said, you want to know what? You haven't been providing me the financial documents I need to properly understand this business, especially documents relating to these big donations you're making in Macau to the University of Macau, I believe it is. And University of Macau, there was Wynn donated $135 million. And he wanted to see the financial paperwork dealing with that and the rules governing his stock and the investment in companies thing. You want to know what? That's my money. I have stock and investment in the company, and you're donating this money to the University of Macau. What's going on? So that ticked Wynn off. And, in fact, there was supposed to be a court hearing about it today. That court hearing's now been moved to March 8th. No one said why this court hearing's been moved to March 8th, but it had. So Wynn says, all right, if that's the way you want to play it, Okada, I'm going to hire Louis Free. Louis Free is the former FBI director. And he hired him and said, go ahead, investigate this Okada guy and investigate, you know, what he's doing in the Philippines. I think he's playing dirty. So Louis Free comes out and he investigates them and he presents Wynn a report that says, my investigations say Okada has been bribing Filipino officials. He bribed them to get the casinos there, and the Filipino society and government is so corrupt that he can't do business in the Philippines without bribing people. And so Wynn says, aha, I've got it. Okada, I am kicking you out of my company. I am forcibly buying your 20% stake. And not only am I forcibly buying your 20% stake in the company, I'm buying at a discount. So you're not even going to get what it's worth. And then he goes to the board and says, this person, by dealing with, by bribing foreign officials, has violated a U.S. law, the Fair Practices, Fair Standards, or something like that, Act. But basically there's a law in the U.S. that says you can't bribe foreign officials, even if you want to do business there. You're just not allowed to do that. And he says, violated the law, he's therefore jeopardizing our gaming licenses in Macau and Las Vegas. We got to kick him off. The board said, okay. And in the middle of the night, Wynn sent Okada an email and said, guess what? We kicked you out, and we forcibly bought your stock out for a discount. And we're talking stock that might have been worth, what, $2.7 billion, somewhere in that neighborhood, and, you know, 1.3, 1.5, the number being thrown around that they were bought for. It's a sizable discount. And so you've got that. And Okada's like, well, no, that's not playing. That's what he's going to sue over that, too, because he's like saying, first of all, I didn't bribe anyone. He got the Filipino officials to come out and say, I'm not bribing anyone. And he says, I'm going to sue you over that. Now, he hasn't filed a lawsuit over this yet, but don't be surprised if he does. Okada is one of the most litigious people on earth. In fact, he's so litigious, he might as well be American and not Japanese. He uses lawsuits to solve everything, whether it's business practices, libel, you name it. He has no problem going to court, and when he goes to court, he wins. And it's very interesting. So now you have these two business partners, just bitter rivals, at each other's throat, and Wynn, and in the ultimate sort of FU move, took the Okada restaurant on his property and took it down. He took down the signs, and it was there one night, and the next night there was a sign that says it's being renovated. You talk about a relationship that's gone south. This one is completely disappeared, and apparently there's going to be an emergency board meeting of Wynn Macau this weekend to kick Okada off the board there as well. So we haven't heard the last of this, but this is, I mean, you got billionaires fighting each other. This is interesting. I mean, the only thing missing is, you know, someone slept with someone else's daughter.
Dan, have you ever had a falling out with a former friend that went this quickly and this badly?
I don't think so. No, not off the top of my head, but let me say I'm not surprised that if someone would have a falling out then this quickly and this badly, Steve Wynn would be at the top of my list of likely candidates. And from what, you know, Vin just said, sounds like this story isn't going away anytime soon, and it's going to get messier and, you know, more dirty laundry. You know, there's so much dirty laundry that goes on in, you know, the casino industry. And then when you add, you know, the Asian casino industry into the mix too, I can't imagine, you know, what else is going to get aired out after this is all said and done.
And Vin, does this have any danger of you know, really, really hurting Wynn in the long term? Obviously, he's saying he's looking out for his own best interest in terms of gaming licenses and those types of things. I'm not even necessarily talking about that, but the reputation or his reputation as being driving a hard bargain and being kind of quick to anger and quick to is that already established?
It could in the sense that, if he's in places where he's now going head-to-head with Okada, where Okada has deeper connections and deeper pockets, then win. This could certainly hurt him in that standpoint. It's probably not going to hurt him in Macau, just because once you're there, they're going to want to work with you. But it's interesting. I think, to me, the real interesting thing that's going to come out of this, though, is one of the things that hasn't happened is the financial documents coming out over the donation to the University of Macau. And I've got to admit, I'm kind of curious now. I want to see the documentation on this. I want to see why Wynn is fighting so hard not to present this documentation. Is there something nefarious going on, or is this just Steve Wynn going, Okada, you can't push me around, and if you do, this is what happens. This has the feeling of, you know, one of those drive-by kneecappings, except it's done in the boardroom instead of out on the street. And I'm curious as to what Okada's going to do next, because Okada didn't get this way by being nice. He's as ruthless as it comes, and the one thing you don't want is you don't want to be in a protracted corporate war. That's just something you don't want. And so, yeah, so that has the potential to be impact. Well, right now, I'd love to be like a fly in Sheldon Adelson's boardroom and just hear him cackling every morning as he reads these stories about Wynn and Okada. And for those of you who don't know, Sheldon Adelson and Steve Wynn are longtime rivals. And for the longest time, didn't really get along at all, although they've made their peace to a certain degree in recent years. But those two have had their share of battles, and it didn't hurt either one of them. And they were direct competitors. But I don't think it ever got as nasty as what's going on with Okada and Wynn. And so, yeah, it has the potential. I mean, if Okada's successful in opening up the Filipino market and Wynn really wanted to get into the Philippines, this could hurt him badly. And if they're going head-to-head and saying competition for a casino in Vietnam, and I'm just throwing countries out. I have no idea if Wynn is interested in expanding to Vietnam, but Vietnam has been cited as a place the industry is interested in expanding to. If he's going head-to-head with Okada in Vietnam, because Okada might not have had any interest in Vietnam, but now just to spite Wynn, he might enter the market there. And that's how things like this work. And so, yes, it could have some long-term impact. But to me, the real interesting question is, why is Wynn fighting so hard not to provide these documents? And that's the unanswered question. And I think that could, in the long run, be the most damaging proposition, if any damage comes out of this at all.
Well, we'll certainly be following it. There's a story up on the we had it included in the Casino City Times newsletter, which goes out every overnight, every Monday. So most people get it on Tuesday mornings. If you are not a subscriber and you would like to subscribe, you can go to CasinoCityTimes.com and you'll get all the latest dirt on those types of things. And you can read the story at CasinoCityTimes.com.
And you can also follow my Twitter feed, because I'm official, and that's at CasinoCityVin, simply because I'm officially Wynn Okada obsessed. So if there's a development in the story, I'll probably tweet something about it, just because it's interesting. Look, when you get billionaires publicly going to war, there are going to be fireworks, and you might as well enjoy the show.
Yeah, Vin follows this with the same zest and zeal that most of the American public is following the Rihanna Chris Brown sort of drama that's going on. So, we're going to move on to our final topic of the day before we go to our best bets. Our final topic of the day, as I alluded to earlier, is the Accenture Match Play Championships. We're not going to necessarily really talk about the golf per se, but Dan this year has got both Vin and me, and then also for former Casino City Times senior editor Gary Trask is also involved in this. It's a pool basically where the Accenture Match Play Championships is a bracket of 64 players, and if you win your match, you advance to the next round, and in the end, after one person has won six matches, he is the champion. And so just like you would in an NCAA basketball pool, you fill out the bracket and you say who you think is going to win every match, and you advance them on until you have a champion, and each round is progressively worth more and more points. So getting a first-round match correct isn't necessarily as important as getting the champion correct. The champion in this case is worth 32 points. A first round match is only worth one. As I alluded to earlier, I managed to do slightly worse than 50%. I was 15 out of 32 in my first round, but I did manage to lose both of my finalists, so I'm not doing very well. Vin is doing a little bit better than me, but Dan, I know you got, I believe, what, 24 out of 32, right? In this pool, is that correct? And how's your final four looking? I think you lost your champion yesterday, didn't you?
Losing the champion hurts in the first round. I had Lem Simpson as my champion. He went out in the first round against Matteo Manassaro, the 19-year-old Italian. And then I have one of my other final four participants, Sergio Garcia, lost in a Spanish versus Spanish match against Miguel Angel Jimenez. So two out of my four final four guys are gone. One of my finalists is still alive. That's Martin Keimer. And then Brent Snedeker is my other finalist, and it took him extra holes to beat Retief Goosen. And that might prove to be a good win for me. If I had lost that one, I'd say having three out of your four finals or knocked out in the first round. It doesn't matter how many you got right in that first round. You're not going to end up winning this pool.
Now, that's one of the things that's kind of fun about this pool, though, is because, I mean, when you look at the NCAA basketball tournament, the reality is that, you know, most people are picking the one seed to advance at least to the Sweet 16. So it's really not that, you know, the first couple of rounds, you know, there maybe are, there's 32 games. There's maybe 10 to 12 games that aren't going to have a very large consensus of people picking a team. So this, you know, is, to be perfectly honest, a complete crapshoot. You know, Vin, what did you do to prepare going into picking this bracket? And as you know, as compared to a college basketball, I know you're a big college basketball fan, so you usually know. I mean, you know more about the 12 seeds than I know about the one seeds when it comes to college basketball, to be perfectly honest. So, but in terms of this, you know, this match play championship, you know, what kind of research did you do going in, and how did that help or hurt you?
Yes. Well, the match play is tough because, look, in college basketball, a one seed has never lost to a 16 seed. It just doesn't happen. And in this championship, it happens all the time. Does that mean I picked a one seed to beat a 16 seed? No. And it cost me because my champion is now out of the event. I'd wanted to do all sorts of research, and I didn't, and I just picked by feel, and the bottom line is that, in fact, I mean, I rushed my picks, but that's okay because I don't think it would have changed that much, and because this is the equivalent of throwing a dart at a dartboard. It really is. This is like saying before the World Series of Poker, which had 7,000 people playing in it, these nine people are going to, this one person's going to win it. That's how hard picking the winner of this is. You have a 1 in 64 chance in this because it's not like the NCAA tournament. You look at the NCAA tournament, you can say, all right, I'm going to throw these. The NCAA tournament, you can handicap like a horse race. You can say, all right, these people I'm going to throw out right away. These people are the next line I'm going to throw out. These people are the next line I'm going to throw out. That leaves me with four possible teams that are going to win it, and this is the team that's going to win. And you can handicap. You can't do that with this because Tiger Woods, by all rights, should have lost yesterday. He got lucky. The guy he was playing apparently had never met his putter, and so things like that happen. So you've got to go with feel, and I think the best way to do it, and Dan, I don't know whether you agree with this or not, but I tried to get a sense for their track record going into it, and then a feel for what they're like in match play, because these players don't play a lot of match play. So if they have a track record in match play, I think that helps. And if you take a look at how the quality of their game going into it and their track record in match play, you have a better shot than most. But there is some skill, because Dan does follow this closely, and he's in first place right now.
Yeah, so Dan, tell us, you know, you're clearly the most knowledgeable when it comes to golf. You know, how important is knowledge in this, or is it just a complete crapshoot?
I think you need some knowledge, but, you know, to kind of go back on Vin's point, you know, you know, you can try to handicap it as much as you want. You know, you couldn't think of a better bet for this tournament than Luke Donald. I mean, he's number one in the world right now. He won this same exact tournament last year. He's by all means, everyone considers him, the top player in the world right now. He's the number one overall seed, and he loses to the 64 seed yesterday. He gets smoked. He loses 5-4. It wasn't really close. You just try to, my rule is, if I don't recognize a guy's name, and there were a few of them, as much as I know about golf, there's still a few random Euros and South Africans that I wasn't completely familiar with. If I don't recognize their name, I don't have them winning. So that's my number one rule.
I will say that next year my draft, my picking philosophy is just going to be, just advance the Asian sounding players, because that seems to work as much as anything else.
Yeah, it didn't work with my KJ Choi as a finalist pick, though.
Ishikawa and Yang and one of the Koreans, Bae, beat Poulter. You really need to get lucky. I was in this pool last year. I think, after the first round, I had 16 wins. And I think I know just as much about golf this year as I did last year. And, we'll see how long my first place lasts. I have a feeling it's not going to last too much longer than my first day.
See, it's interesting because I'm in Masters pools, too. Because, I do follow golf. And I'm a golf fan. I like to watch the game. And, I know who's who in the world rankings and that sort of thing, and generally who's playing well and who isn't. So it wasn't that much of a stretch for me to just pick it completely based on feel, well, not a whole lot of research going in. But generally when I do the Masters pools, I do significantly better than I do when I pick the match play, the Accenture, simply because the Accenture, at least to me, Dan, feels like a lot more of a crapshoot than the Masters, doesn't it?
Oh, without doubt. The margin for error in the match play is so much lower. And then with the Masters, there's guys with proven track records at that specific course in that moment. It's a lot easier to bet than, the match play, which has moved to, it hasn't just been at one course every year. It's been at a few different courses, especially in Arizona. And, the difference in skill level on one day between the number one seed and the number 64 seed is much, much smaller than the difference, in skill level that could, show itself in a four-day tournament. Usually in a four-day, the larger the sample size, the cream usually rises to the top, and that's not necessarily the case when you're playing one guy for 18 holes.
Yeah, if you shoot a 72 on day one, all right, you might be 6-7 shots off the pace, but you could turn around and shoot a 68 the next day and be right back in the tournament, whereas you shoot a 72 on day one of the Accenture, you're done. You're out.
Yep. You're packing.
You're packing. It's unbelievable. Or you could shoot a 73, and normally that would knock you out of contention, or 74, normally that would knock you out of contention in the major, but the guy you happen to be playing shot a 76, and you're advancing.
And it's not even that. It's even, you could shoot a 74 and the guy shoots a 68 and you still win. It's because because the hole wouldn't be played out to this. But, you throw up a triple, what would be a triple bogey, and, the other guy shoots a birdie. Okay, well, that would be a 4-point, it would never get that far because the hole would be conceded before then. So it's definitely, obviously, the different, the fact that, you can play really terribly in a hole, and a guy misses a 2-foot, or a 3-foot
putt, and then
you have the hole.
Well, that's why, to me, games played with a modified Stableford scoring system, Aaron just rolled his eyes.
I think they're intriguing and they're fun a couple times a year.
I like watching those because those take into account the vagaries you're talking about. They reward birdies and aggressive plays and eagles and they penalize you for making mistakes, and I think it's a lot of fun.
Well, the reason we're talking about this actually is just because it's such an interesting thing to have a pool in. It's a bracket. Everyone. Almost everybody in the United States fills out a March Madness bracket.
Well, that's the beauty of bracket things. Brackets are made to bet on. If you can put something in a bracket format, you can get people to bet on it. It really doesn't matter what it is.
It's So we were talking in the office before the show, you know, what would be some great things to you know, put in a bracket format. And Vin, you had a couple intriguing ideas. Give us at least one of them.
I want to do the Oscars in a bracket, the best movie in a bracket, and you know, throw it up there. I think it would be great.
So throughout the broadcast, you know, eventually awards.
Well, yeah, if you could do American Idol and The Voice and all of this stuff and Dancing with the Stars with the texting and the voting and all of that sort of stuff, you could figure it out for the Oscars. And get it in and do it in a bracket style and gamble on it and see what the outcome's going to be. I think that would be fantastic to do it that way. Or if you don't want to do it with the voting, just say, all right, here are the 8 finalists, and we're going to advance it, and here's the 1 seed and the 8 seed, the 2 and the 7, and here's how it is, and have them advance in the bracket and see whether you agreed with the voters or disagreed with the voters and were able to pick it out. I think it'd be great rather than, I mean, people do Oscar pools now where you got to pick the winner in each category, and you get enough winners in each category, that's fine. But I think if you can turn it into a bracket sport, then you're talking. You're going from a sort of niche betting event to a mass market betting event. And that's what you want to do with these sorts of things, don't you?
When I was working in college athletics, you know, we used to most of my work in college athletics was at the Division III level, and so when we would have teams get into an NCAA tournament, and even sometimes when we had teams that weren't in an NCAA tournament, some of us in the office would fill out a bracket for, say, the Division III men's soccer.
Yeah, I'm sure the NCAA is going to love hearing that.
Oh, well, we of course never placed a wager. This was just a for entertainment.
Of course,
you know, sort of prospect, but yeah, we'd always fill one out, and that was fun because, really, I mean, you did know something about maybe 5 or 6 of the teams that were in the tournament. You knew stuff about the Northeastern teams because you know I was working in the Northeast, but you know the teams out in the Midwest and you know on the West Coast and in the South, you never saw one of those teams play ever, you know, and you didn't know what the competition was like down there. You really had no clue. So that was always a lot of fun. Dan, do you have any things that, you know, could be turned into a bracket event that would make it a lot more fun?
Well, I was struggling to think of something, and, you know, I talked to you before the show starts, and I think this one was so obvious that I'm an idiot for even missing it. It's Division I college football. You know, people have been clamoring for some sort of tournament for years and years and years. You know, as much fun as bowl pools are, and I did well enough in a bowl pool this year where I won a couple $100, I would much rather have an 8 or a 16 team bracket. It takes a month, and we have a true national champion without, you know, any of this controversy that sometimes happens, you know, when, you know, especially when a one loss team wins the national championship. And you got teams like Boise State and TCU who are shut out of the championship game. You know, a bracket would be a good equalizer, and I think it would generate so much interest. You know, college football is wildly popular, anyways. When you add the March Madness element to it, I think it'd be such a home run. You know, I know Vin knows a lot more about the college football business behind the scenes, and you know, there's a lot of hoops you have to go through for this to ever happen, you know. But you know that's hopefully in my lifetime, you know, I'll be able to watch a college football tournament, Division I.
Yeah, I mean that would be fantastic to see a college football bracket, because college football lends itself to the one and done, just like college basketball does. It would really be a lot of fun. Is it going to happen? God, it would be nice to think so, but there is something to be said for the bowl system too, and it's interesting. And this is a whole other discussion. It's getting to the point where the bowls need college football more than college football need the bowls at this point. And there is something to be said for that. And so we'll see what happens. College hockey already has a bracket. They've got the Frozen Four, just like the NCAA has the basketball has the Final Four, and that's a lot of fun. I just want to throw this out there because I think it's intriguing, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. But if you take baseball and you don't have to get rid of the best of seven series or anything like that. But if you take baseball and you say you take the top, is 16 too much? But you are 12, or you set it up so that, all right, you've got X number of teams get into the brackets in baseball. And it doesn't matter, American League, National League, whatever it is. You for the purposes of the tournament, the league concept is gone. I mean, you've got interleague play already. These teams are pretty much the same. So never mind the whole AL pennant champion wins the meets the NL pennant champion. You skip all of that. Do it like the College World Series. Or where you've got
a double elimination bracket.
Yeah, double elimination bracket. I think that would make the baseball playoffs way more interesting than they are right now. It would be fantastic because then you get a bunch of teams in there. You do the double elimination bracket. You know exactly. You can see what their walk through the field is going to be. You've got a one team versus a 16. The one seed clearly has the advantage, but you don't know if they're going to make it through because this is baseball. And I think the baseball playoffs will be a lot more interesting if they were set up that way than their current format right now. Because in the current format right now, no one cares unless your team is in it. And that's the bottom line. So when the Red Sox are out of the playoffs, they're done with baseball. Red Sox fans are done with baseball for the most part. Not everyone, but for the most part, it's the same thing. If you're in Kansas City, you really don't care about the playoffs. If you're a fan of the Angels, you don't care once the Angels are out. You just don't. And like the Phillies fans, they have no choice to care because there's half of them live in the New York market, and the Yankees are always in the playoffs, so they're just ticked off. And rooting against the Yankees. So, but it's one of those things where I think that would work, and I think it would make the baseball playoffs more interesting. And I think those are the sorts of things you have to look at as you're trying to juice professional sports and keep things interesting, is moving to a bracket-style thing. Because the bracket-style thing, it just generates excitement. I mean, one of the nice things about the Olympics and, say, Olympic hockey is, yeah, you have the round-robin part that determines who moves into the knockout round. But once you get to the knockout round, there's a bracket. And you can see, all right, if you're in this bracket, you're going to avoid, you're going to go down this path. You're in this bracket, you're going to go down this path. And it works out really nicely. And that's part of what makes the Olympic hockey easy and fun to follow. It's part of what makes the World Cup fun. Yeah, you've got the knockout round. Not the knockout round. Yeah, you have the group stage, which is a round robin. Once you get out of the group stage, it's a bracket. And brackets are easy to follow. It just works out nicely, and I think those are games that lend themselves well to Rick. But I'd love to see baseball do it. It'll never happen.
It'll never happen. There's too many travel logistics. It's too.
I don't even think it's the travel logistics that have anything to do with it. I think they're.
Well, you don't know what teams are going to be playing when until. Like, there's not a series set. Like, if you win, then you play in one game. If you lose, then you play in another. And it'd be so many moving parts. I agree it would be interesting.
But the funny thing is, I think the travel logistics can be solved. I mean, that'll be raised as the number one objection. I think that's sort of a red herring in terms of objections. I think the reason it's not going to happen is baseball's a traditional game.
You also have fewer postseason games, I think.
Yeah, you set up for more postseason games, but baseball's a traditional sport. It's a very traditional sport, and they don't want to... They don't want to change it dramatically. This is the way the game has been, and you know, through the ages, you're able to compare players and this and that and all this sort of stuff. And even if it's more exciting for the fans and all this sort of stuff, it's not going to happen because it's too big a change to the game. And baseball does well with incremental change. It doesn't do well with radical change.
Well, the one thing that I'm looking forward to setting up a bracket for is normally at the end of our poker games. Before we play it, we play cash for a while, and then we play. Then we usually play a tournament, and in between, while everyone's getting arranged, a few of us decide to play what's called catch a wave, where you basically, you know, you flip over a card and then you call high low, and whoever builds the longest string of correct answers on that high low, on the guesses of high low, ends up winning the whole pot. Well, the next time we have eight players that are willing to do that, I'm going to suggest that we do a basically a hold'em bracket. So we set up a bracket beforehand. Everyone gets dealt their whole cards, and then we deal a board for each match. So, you know, the seeds really don't matter. It all just matters what the, you know, what the cards are. So if you have pocket aces, if you have eight people, then you have to beat, you have to win in three heads-up matches. And if you win in three heads-up matches, then you win the pot. And you could win just as easily with deuce seven, depending on how the board runs out. So I think that'll be fun. I'm hoping we get eight players tonight, and we'll give it a shot.
Yeah, and just so you know, this is a game that sometimes occurs on the side at the Casino City Hole game, when players are not involved in the action, and there's, you know, a pot building and lots of players in it, and there might be two players on the side that say, well, instead of watching them, let's do this. And you deal out two cards apiece, run out a board, and whoever wins, wins. We call them flippaments.
And so I think setting up a bracket for the flippament would be a lot of fun. We'll have to see if I can convince seven other souls to do it tonight at the Casino City home game, but we're going to give it a shot. Well, in lieu of best bets this week, and I'm not sure how I did last week. I thought I had saved my bets somewhere on my computer, but if I did, I don't have access to it right now, and unfortunately I didn't have time to listen to last week's podcast to remind myself what I had picked. But in lieu of our best bets this week, we're going to do some Oscar picks. But before we get to those, I want to remind you that you can listen to the Casino City Gang live at 11 a.m. Eastern time on Thursdays at blogtalkradio.com/Spartion. You can also access archives of the program to listen to on your iPod or MP3 player. And you can find us on the Casino City family of websites, including CasinoCityTimes.com and online.CasinoCity.com. So I think we should discuss four categories: Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Picture. I'm looking at Bodog's odds right now because Bovada's odds, because I live in the United States. But I have a feeling that the odds at Bodog are exactly the same as the ones offered at Bovada. But that said, we'll start with Best Director. Michelle, and I've seen maybe one of the movies that's even mentioned on any of these, so I'm not knowledgeable, so don't listen to me, and please excuse me as I hack these people's names. But Michelle
Hazanavicius.
Thank you. The guy that directed The Artist. He's the overwhelming favorite at 1 to 10. And then Martin Scorsese for Hugo is at 5.5 to 1, or I guess 11 to 2. Alexander Payne for The Descendants is at 20 to 1. Terrence Malick of Tree of Life is at 40 to 1, as is Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris. Vin, why don't you handicap this one for us?
Oh, look, The Artist is the overwhelming favorite for almost everything. And for good reason. I mean, not for good reason. It's a silent picture, basically. And
it's a silent film?
Yes.
Oh, it shouldn't even be up for nominations. Are you kidding me? I am protesting the Oscars as I do every year.
And there's a novelty factor to it. There's sort of a media darling factor to it. And so when you throw all of those in, you sort of have to like the chances there. If you're looking for a long shot, I think Woody Allen is probably the best value from a long shot. What, you said 20 to 1?
40 to 1.
40 to 1. Yeah, I mean, Woody Allen is a long shot to do this, but this was Woody Allen's best picture in a long time. Woody Allen is a favorite of the Academy. I mean, he's a favorite of actors and actresses everywhere. This was a very clever movie he did, set in Paris, where you've got a writer dreaming about who wishes he was part of, you know, 1920s Paris, and then you've got, you know, he go through sort of his sort of fantasies, and then he meets people that wanted to be back in earlier time, and then people want to be back earlier time, and it's an interesting movie. It's clever, it's smart, it's whimsical, it's funny. If you're looking for a long shot, Woody Allen, and that's the thing. You're getting absolutely no value on betting The Artist here. Betting that it's actually The Artist. He's most likely to win. The critics love it. The Academy loves these types of specialty stuff. So yeah, I think this is the type of role that normally would go to The Artist director. But if you're looking for a long shot, I'd book the Woody Allen thing. You got a long shot in mind, Dan?
Not really. Not, you know, I think with these long shots, you're just throwing your money away. You know, Alexander Payne, maybe. The Senate's got some good buzz. But, you know, Michelle, I think that's his first name. He's going to win this. There's really no doubt about it. And I think you might as well just be burning the money if you're going for a long shot. I think that's the case for a couple of these categories, too. I think that's the case for Best Picture. The Artist, I'm at Patty Power. I'm looking at Patty Power's odds right now on my computer. And, yeah, Patty Power 1-16.
I'm at oddschecker.com, and the Artist is at 1-16 at Bet365, 1-16 at SkyBet, 1-14 at Totesport.
He's 1-12 at Bovada.
Yeah, 1-12 at Bovada, 1-14 at Betfred, 1-16 at Patty Power, 1-10 at Stan James, which might be, and 1-10 at B1. And so Stan James, if you're looking to book some action on the Artist, Stan James looks like it might be your best option.
Well, in terms of Best Picture, I'm going to take The Help. I already advertised that earlier. And I can't remember some column I wrote a week or two ago, but I'm going to take The Help at 12-1.
Well,
it's the only film that is up for Best Picture that I have actually seen.
Well, the Help, I mean, if you're looking for long shots, the Help probably has to be at the top of the list in terms of long shots. In a 28-1 at Bet Victor, which looks like the best.
Do your line shopping, people.
28-1
versus 12-1. I'll take 28-1 any day.
Yeah, it's 28-1 at Bet Victor, and you've got to like The Help at that price, simply because it has all the elements that Oscar contenders like. I mean, Oscar voters like. It's got, you know, the aspirational element, the self-help element, the racial component. It's sort of a picture about bigger themes and broader issues, and it's a period piece. So all of that stuff works in its favor. I mean, I still like The Artist, though. I think it's more than likely to win. I think those elements that I talked about in The Help, I think they're going to help in other categories more than they will in the Best Picture category.
Well, speaking of the Best Actress category, Viola Davis is the favorite in that category. For The Help at 4-7, these are Bovada's odds. Finn may have some other options for you there in a minute. But Meryl Streep is next at 7-5 for The Iron Lady. Michelle Williams for My Week with Marilyn is at 15-1, and then other long shots are Rooney Mara for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo at 30-1, and Glenn Close for Albert Nobbs at 50-1. Dan, what's your take on this one? It's a little bit closer on this. Are you going to go with Viola Davis or Meryl Streep, or take one of the long shots?
I think Davis is, you know, if I had money to bet, I'd probably bet on Davis. But it's a two horse race. You know, both Davis and Streep have gotten a lot of rave reviews for their performances. Streep's, I think she's been nominated 18 times for Best Actress, something crazy like that. 18 Oscars. She's only won twice, I think. I guess she had Margaret Thatcher down to a T. But I think, you know, as the odds makers have shown, Davis is the overwhelming favorite here, and I think she's the one that's going to, you know, grab the hardware come Sunday night.
Vin, any better odds at other locations?
Well, I mean, there are three things to keep in mind if you're handicapping this. Right? I think Viola Davis is rightly the favorite. I think because The Help isn't going to win Best Picture, they're going to try and get The Help an Oscar somewhere. And one thing to think of is, especially if you've got online betting options, is if The Help gets a Best Supporting Actress nod or Best Supporting Actress win, you might want to jump on either Meryl Streep, because the Academy just loves Meryl Streep. You might want to jump on Meryl Streep to win, and you're getting decent odds on Meryl Streep. I mean, with Viola Davis, 8-13 looks like the best you're getting. You're getting 4-7 at Patty Power, which is good. With Meryl Streep, though, you can get 6-5. Or 11-10, and that's pretty good too. You can get 6-5 at Sporting Bet and 11-10 at Patty Power, and so
seven to five at Bovada. That actually might be the best.
Yeah, that might be the best. And then the other thing is, and I'm just going to throw this out there. Rooney Mara, the girl with a dragon tattoo, if you're looking for a long shot, you know, if you're looking at this like a horse race and you're looking for someone to come from just deep in the field out of nowhere to win it, Rooney Mara might be the character simply because she plays a fabulous character, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo was such a global phenomenon, such an international hit. I could see if there's going to be like one completely shocking out-of-nowhere surprise in the Oscars, this would be the category in Rooney Mara pulling off the upset. I mean, she's a long shot for a reason, but if you're looking to place down $5 or $10, I mean, your return, you're not going to get any return on Viola Davis. You're not going to get any return on Meryl Streep. I mean, but you will get a return on Rooney Mara. I mean, she's at 125-1 at Ladbrokes, which is just fantastic for a $10 bet. You're not going to make any money off a $10 bet off of Viola Davis or Meryl Streep, but if you're looking for that long shot that actually could surprise anyone, I think this is the category.
Well, gentlemen, we're out of time for this week. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Casino City Gang. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll be back with us again next week when we continue to discuss everything that's interesting in the world of gambling. The music for the Casino City Gang is provided by the PodSafe Music Network. The show is for entertainment purposes only and does not endorse any illegal activity. Please be sure gambling is legal in your jurisdiction before placing any wagers.